Accession number 10657, Rule 15.
Major Lewis, Rule 15. You were describing the area called the Burqa.
Yes, I think that both Cairo and Alexandria had areas which the troops were allowed to go to, where there were bars and brothels and massage parlours and all that sort of thing. So some of them used to go there. Others had go on the beach and spend the day on the beach at City Bish or something and go swimming. It just depended on how they wanted to spend their leave time, really. Others, a few didn't actually go out of the camp. They might be they'd sit down and write letters or something like that, you know. But there were facilities for the troops if they wanted to go down into the Burqa area. They weren't forbidden to go down.
What about restaurants and places like that?
Oh, restaurants were... yes, plenty of places. I mean, you know, Alex was... With its large French... quite a large French population, it was well off for restaurants, actually. But I can only remember the Carlton, because the Carlton was more or less where we used to meet up in the evenings if we were in Alexandria. There was also a hotel we stayed at in Alex called Le Roy, when we did stay in Alex at a later stage, which was used also by the American fighter pilots who were with the Desert Air Force, and we got on very well with them. They were a good crowd.
Did you see anything of the RAF when you were at Mariupolis? Did they come?
No, they were. I mean, the landing grounds were very near to Mariupolis, but they didn't come over to visit us or anything. They were too busy, I think, at that particular time. You know, this was a situation where the RAF didn't have to go very far on their sorties. You know, the Germans and the Italians were in the Alamein line just a few minutes away, really. Shall I just switch back to this little bit about Mariupolis?
Yes.
Bit of information here that whilst we were there, we actually... can I switch it off? going back to Mariupolis briefly. A and D companies were not formed at Mariupolis, and we only had B Company and C Company. B Company commanded by Ian Pitt and C Company by Tony Jones. Because of the limited number of troops that we got there, it was difficult really to plan any ambitious training. This situation was worsened really towards the end of July when several officers were sent to the Middle East Training Center in Palestine near Tel Aviv. And very soon after they had gone, those officers had gone to the Middle East Training Center, the next day the 8th Battalion was warned to provide a company for operations with the 6th DLI. B Company was the only company at Mariupolis, and Ian Pitt was told at a brigade conference that the company was required for a special digging job in the line. In fact, there were going to be three companies, one from the 6th, one from the 8th, and one from the 9th. But in fact, it didn't turn that out that way at all. The three companies were really required for an attack which would be carried out by this composite battalion. It was a position called Ruin Ridge. Two attacks had already been made on the ridge, which had been costly failures, and the third was to be carried out by the composite battalion for the night of July 26, 27, supported by artillery and tanks. Now the rest of this is really the story of the B Company activities in this particular attack. Shall I go on with that one?
Well, you might explain why the attack led to the capture of the company.
Yes.
Because you weren't there, were you?
No, I wasn't there. I'd gone off. I had left the Sidibe rest camp. Gone back to to Mariupolis quickly to collect my kit, where I'd seen Ian Pitt, who'd told me that they'd got a special job, and I'd then gone off to the Middle East Training Centre in Palestine.
But you discussed it with Ian Pitt when you got back.
Ah, when I got back from Mariupolis,
yes.
I think by that time, when I came back to Mariupolis, by that time they'd been to this brigade conference, they'd been told that an attack had been planned, and I think Pitt knew that the previous two attacks had failed, and was very envious of me disappearing from the scene, as it were, and going off to the Middle East Training Centre.
What did you hear about it then when you got back from Middle East Training Centre?
Well, all we heard when we... In fact, I think we heard about it at the Middle East Training Centre, actually, that the complete composite battalion had gone in the bag. That was the three companies, one from each of the battalions, had completely gone in the bag. What had happened was, briefly, that they had in fact gained their objective. The tanks were supposed to come up and take over from them, but no tanks appeared because they were busy on the other side of Ruin Ridge, helping the Australians to extricate themselves, and both the Australians and the tanks had heavy casualties, so no British tanks arrived. And so far as the company was concerned, although they'd got onto the objective, they'd got six Bren guns with only a few magazines, one 2-inch mortar, one anti-tank rifle. The troops were confident that they could hold until the arrival of the tanks at daylight if they could get the reserve company up, but communications broke down. Wireless contact with the reserve company did not exist. Two officers were sent back to bring up the reserve company and disappeared, were never seen again. So B Company of the 8th Battalion was left actually on its own. Two German half-tracks appeared at dawn. B Company knocked out one with the anti-tank rifle and got most of the crew with the 2-inch mortar when they went to ground. The second one turned away. They also hit that and it went up in flames.
What did they hit that with? With the mortar?
Could be, or it could have been the anti-tank rifle again. It doesn't actually say. No, Bren guns, I think. They opened up on Brens and hit it anyway, and it went up in flames. Could be petrol cans or something like that. And of course morale was very good. Next thing that happened was that they got shelled for half an hour by our own guns, either because they were shelling the half tracks or the area of the half tracks, and they certainly weren't aware, as they should have been, of where B Company was, which implies that the gunnery OP officer wasn't with the company. When the shelling stopped at 9:30, this is about 9:30 in the morning, it was very hot, there was very little water, no food, and as I've explained, very little ammunition, and no British tanks. Then about 400 yards away, a captured British jeep appeared on the scene, and they could see through their field glasses that there was a German officer in the jeep. So they opened up on him, but missed him, and he went off towards his own lines. And it was quite obvious then that we had been spotted, or the B company had been spotted. 20 minutes later, the German tanks, they were Mark 3s, closed in. Some of them got in rear of the positions, and they opened very heavy fire at about 150 yards, which is, there is nothing you can do about that at all, absolutely nothing. They couldn't hit back. They got this one anti-tank rifle, and as soon as that fired, I would imagine it would have been knocked out. There was nothing else apart from the Brens. So the whole company was rounded up and taken prisoner. There were only a few survivors of that composite battalion that actually got back to Mariupolis. And B Company, 60 of B Company, were taken prisoner, including the company commander, Captain Pitt. So it was really a rather sad operation.
How far ahead of our own main lines were they when they were out in their little position?
I think they went about 1,000 yards or so. Wait a second. Doesn't say. They went on foot to the start line. You see, the thing is that the Germans were on at the top of this hill, I think. Where are we? Just a second. Yes, you've got a situation here, you see, where the battalion objective was Ruin Ridge. The Germans and Italian infantry, holding it very strongly, were on the top of the ridge. When B Company, in fact, captured the ridge, the Germans turned tail and the Italians and ran back up the ridge and down the other side.
It sounds rather strange that B Company couldn't undertake some sort of visual signalling back to the main lines if they were up on a slope. Presumably
they would have been on, yes, on
visible.
Exactly. But unless you've laid on something previously, like you're going to fire a very light signal of some sort, to say that I don't think there would have been any signals actually that you could use for that situation.
What about signalling with mirrors, Morse, something like that?
I don't suppose anybody thought of that, but that is something that you could do. Something that you, if you're knowing where you're signalling to. But there again, you know, the desert being as vast as it is, it's all very close at the top of the ridge, and the Germans aren't far away. But probably where they'd come from, there would be nothing that you could see, and certainly you wouldn't see a great deal in the early morning with the heat haze coming up and getting worse and worse as midday came closer. You know, the heat was so intense that you very often couldn't see more than about a couple of hundred yards or so. So I don't think they could have got that. They sent these two officers back, one after the other, and they obviously didn't get there, so no messages got back. That was one failure of communications. The other, of course, was the fact that the tanks weren't able to disengage from helping the Australians, and they couldn't keep their rendezvous with B Company, which in fact had done pretty well to get that hill, because they were met by very, very heavy defensive fire and had fairly heavy casualties going up the slopes. But the last 200 yards, as it says in Ian Pitt's report, they charged, firing the Brens from the hips, firing Bren guns from the hip, fixed bayonets, and they dislodged the enemy from the slopes, and they ran backwards up the ridge. So they'd done the job. They'd got on the objective. And having got there, there was no support of any sort. And you can't do much with one anti-tank rifle against Mark III tanks coming at you from two or three different directions.
You do say further on in another context that consolidation is always more difficult than actually attacking.
I think, well, it's difficult if you don't get on quickly and do it. I mean, it's difficult because you've got to get... It wasn't... you've got to get the troops in the right frame of mind to get down to it straight away. You know, there's no question of lying down and taking a breather or anything like that. As soon as you get on the objective, you've got to make certain that you can turn everything round so that you're facing in the right direction. And if you've got to dig slit trenches deeper, you dig them deeper. And if you need any more, you get cracking on that as well. So I don't, knowing Ian Pitt, I think that he would have got on with that. He would have consolidated the position. But as I say, it was a hopeless situation with tanks encircling them, in actual fact.
Well, especially considering the German policy of always putting in a counterattack as soon as possible.
As soon as they possibly could, yes. Yes, exactly.
Did the Italians follow a similar sort of pattern of behaviour? Did they counterattack as soon as possible if they'd been pushed off a position?
Not that I can remember, no. Not that I can remember. Certainly they didn't at Gazala, at the Strickland's battle. They didn't put in another attack then, on that occasion.
Now, you were at Middle East Training Centre. Can you remember how long your training course there took?
I think it was either 2 or 3 weeks. Something like that. It wasn't just a 3 or 4 day course, definitely not.
What sort of course? Was it a sort of platoon commander's course or company commander's
course?
Company
commander's course, and specialist courses, you know, for mortars and carriers and that sort of thing. So, and I think also, I think I'm right in saying that the CO was there for a brief period, Colonel Jackson. So they must also have had courses going for senior officers.
But you would have been on the company commander's
course. Company commander's course, yes, that's right.
Can you remember anything of the syllabus and the way it was taught?
No, all I remember is that we had two New Zealand officers, I would imagine from the 2nd New Zealand Division, who were at the Middle East Training Centre, to teach us, so that we were being taught by people who'd actually seen quite a lot of action. I remember their names. One was Poole and the other was Widdup, W-I-D-D-U-P. They were very good at their job, and it was certainly not a waste of time going there.
Can you remember what you learned that you didn't already know? You know, did anything strike you suddenly as being, this is new, you know, or this is better than the way I've been doing it up till now?
I don't think so. I think we were what we needed to do, even at that stage, was to perfect the technique of night attacks and keeping direction. So we did a certain amount of work on that. That was one thing. The other thing was the use of the compass. And I remember we were sent out on various compass bearings, and which would involve rough ground or something like that. And then at a given time, whoever was in charge of the exercise would fire a very light, or fire a flare rather, and would then actually show up where we had arrived, which sometimes was slap bang on where we should be, and other times we were way off. So that was quite quite sort of logical, sensible training, because we had to depend on the compass a tremendous amount in the desert.
Was the training mainly outside in the field, or did you have CIA?
No, it was mainly, I would say, mainly in the classroom, really. It was like going on a course to one of the Oxford colleges or something like that, you know. It was inside mainly, apart from these night operations when we would go out and do this compass work.
How were you organised for this? Were you in large classes or small syndicates? Or
I think, well, you would have syndicates and sand tables, of course, and territorial exercises without troops and all that sort of business. And then you'd have syndicates, I would think, of about 6 people, something like that.
And this was located at Tel Aviv?
No, it wasn't at Tel Aviv, actually. The Middle East Training Centre was at Gaza, I think. Gaza. Is it still running, the tape?
Mm.
Oh. It, yes, the Middle East Training Centre, Sarafand, I think it was. I'm not sure, but I think it was Sarafand, and that was near Tel Aviv. So it was fairly easy to get in there from, to get into Tel Aviv from the METC.
What was Tel Aviv like?
Oh, Tel Aviv was a very, very bright and gay and bustling, busy place in 1942. Very much... Oh, it had everything there. There were some very good hotels, bars, the taxi services were good, the restaurants were good. In fact, Tel Aviv was a better spot to go on leave than Alexandria. Some good shops too, where you could, you know, go and buy yourself a decent New Zealand shirt or something like that, because the New Zealanders always had better. Better battle dress than we did. They had a darker coloured battle dress, and some of the shops had got these shirts, so you could buy one of those. Now, Tel Aviv was very popular with everybody, and being at the METC, we would finish on the Friday night and very often be able to go into Tel Aviv and spend Saturday night there. So we were there Saturday and Sunday. We stayed at a small hotel, actually, more or less in the city centre, which was run by a man who was very, very pro-British. So it all worked well.
You say pro-British. Was there any sign of tension or political difficulty?
No, there was no sign of tension, but it was pretty obvious even in those days that they didn't really like us very much. You know, I think they were... they weren't involved in the war to any great extent, although they had one or two troop-carrying companies, but you could feel that there was a little bit of resentment from them towards the British troops. There were no demonstrations and no outward signs or anything like that. But although it was a jolly good place to go on leave and they'd take your money, you couldn't say that they were really all that friendly.
What about tension between the two communities there, between the Arabs and the...
I don't think that was too bad, because I remember on a Sunday morning we actually went out to Gaza, which of course now is in the Gaza Strip, one Sunday morning, just to have, you know, to have sort of free lunch drinks at a hotel out there. And there was nothing that I can remember that there was no open hostility between the Jews and the Arabs at that time, that I can remember anyway.
How did you get to and from the METC?
Taxi, probably, I should think. It wasn't all that far. Or if a truck happened to be going in, or if... probably, if I remember rightly, I went in once with Poole and Widdop, because they'd got their own transport, and they gave us a lift. But if you couldn't get a lift... I think mostly from the METC, there was plenty of transport to get you into Tel Aviv, actually. You've got to find your own way back again, of course, which meant you've got to arrange with somebody on the Sunday to meet them somewhere and pick them up for a lift back. It was easier to get in than it was to get back.
How did you get to there, though, from Egypt? Was that by train?
By train, I think. Yes, we would have done. By train, I think so, from Cairo. And I think we went across at Kassassin, I think was the name of the place, and we would have gone up by train. I don't suppose the train went as far as Tel Aviv, though. I don't honestly remember, but I do remember going over the I suppose it was the canal, wasn't it, at Kassassin? And over that, so we must have been on a train.
Was the terrain around the Middle East Training Centre similar to that in the desert?
Well, it was fairly flat mostly, but it had got the odd hump, which is where it was useful for these compass exercises, you know. But as I say, I think a lot of, most of the work we did really was done inside in the classrooms with the syndicates.
On looking at the sort of theoretical training in tactics, if you remember, were you told anything about battalion and brigade tactics?
No. Not unless they were doing something out of the ordinary. You know, it was usually two brigades up and one in reserve, two battalions up and one in reserve, two companies up, one in reserve, two platoons up, one in reserve. That was the general picture, really. But if there was anything unusual, I doubt then whether we would have been told, because it's applied really to our own brigade. If one of our own battalions was doing something unusual, like swinging round or something, or swinging into line with the other two at a given time, we would have been informed about that because of the fact that they were coming up on our right-hand side.
But when you were doing the sand table exercises and things like that, did they...
Oh, it went above company stuff there.
It did?
Oh, yes, it went to battalion and probably to brigade level as well, with the sand table things, yes. Oh, it was a much wider spectrum than we'd had before, of desert training anyway.
What about the cooperation of other arms like the artillery or the Desert Air Force? Was that discussed at ETC?
You know, General Montgomery had not been very happy about the way in which the Desert Air Force was cooperating when he arrived in the Middle East. Rather not very happy about the liaison between the Army and the Air Force. So I think there was much more importance placed on working with the Air Force than there had been before. So far as the gunners and the sappers were concerned, we'd worked a lot with them anyway. You know, at Ghazala we'd more or less perfected the technique of having a gunner OP officer who could call down fire for you and travelled with you. And I mean, that's really what it was always about. Even at Alamein, the gunner OPs with the infantry, they called down fire. That was what it was all about. So we didn't have to learn a lot about that, but we did have to learn about minefield breaching, because that was going to become very important, or was considered to be very important, considered that it would be very important. In actual fact, of course, there were many occasions when, because the sappers hadn't picked up the mines, or because they'd been written off, or because the sort of mine detectors weren't working, we had to walk through the minefields. You couldn't hang around waiting for somebody else to come up and do it for you. So there were many occasions when infantry had to walk through the minefields because they couldn't stop. Sometimes it was all right because it was a dummy minefield, which nobody knew about. You didn't know whether it was live or not. On other occasions, we got pretty heavy casualties doing it.
What about armour? Because you hadn't seen much armour, had you?
Very little, because up until a very late stage at Ghazala, the tanks weren't allowed outside the boxes, if you remember. We did have some training with Valentine tanks, but not at the Middle East Training Centre. Although I think we would have done some exercises there, some sand table exercises with tanks. Wasn't quite so important. It didn't turn out to be quite so important with us because we didn't ride on the tanks, but some units did. And I'll come to the training bit later on that we did with the Valentines.
So you had a few weeks at
METC, Middle East Training Centre,
and then you went back. Did you go back to Mariupolis to rejoin the battalion?
No, I don't think so. I think I went through this a little bit earlier on and we wrote it off, but it's this business again about the general situation. Yes. In the at Alamein, August the 13th, when General Montgomery arrived at 8th Army HQ. General Strafford, having been shot down in a transport plane, he would have taken over the 8th Army. And Montgomery made it very clear straight away that he had a mandate for the destruction of Axis forces in North Africa, that a new atmosphere was going to be created, the bad old days were over, we'd got to stand and fight it out, there would be no withdrawals, and a great British offensive was to be planned. He spent several days touring the 8th Army, although he didn't get out to us at Mariupolis. But the result of the tour and the result of senior officers passing down Montgomery's enthusiasm to junior officers got through to the troops as well, and the result was that morale went up considerably and there was a tremendous enthusiasm to get down as quickly as possible to the job in hand. After a couple of weeks, we're getting to about the end of August, the Desert Army was ready. A closer liaison had been established with the Royal Air Force. The Sherman tanks and self-propelled guns were arriving for the use of the Desert Army, and intensive training was ordered, particularly breaching minefields, because of the vast minefields that protected both the Axis front